From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Eso, eso, eso.
This week, love. Nothing else can provide so much joy and so much pain. But what happens when being undocumented makes your love hard to show?
He has no idea how long he's going to be able to continue to be in his children's lives. He doesn't know if he's going to be asked to leave in 3 months, in 3 years.
We have true stories of Latino love and sex without love and for money.
People of color, blacks and Latinos in this country, make up a really large number of folks who are involved in the sex trades. And there's reasons for that. And those reasons don't look like what we're predominantly thought of when we think of like sex trafficking. They're actually tied to economic issues.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we justify your love this week. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
No me acercaré a tu jardín. Nunca tocaré tu flor. Es mejor la fantasía que me dio tu leve cercanía y su color.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The border between San Diego, California and Tijuana, Mexico is one of the busiest international crossings in the world, and that has a dark side. People, especially girls, being bought, sold, and forced into labor or sex. A recent high-profile case in San Diego netted dozens of arrests for sex trafficking. But on the Mexican side of the border, there are few resources for the victims. Recently, a resident of San Diego opened a shelter in Tijuana just for trafficked girls. It's one of only two in all of Mexico. Brooke Binkowski has our story.
On a sunny day in a big walled-off house in an upscale part of Tijuana, five young girls are learning the piano. Upstairs, Marisol Garcia tells her story. She was smuggled into San Diego from Tijuana and sold into slavery to a man who raped and beat her. She was 12.
And I told him, you know, after everything finished, I said, you know what, please let me go, you know. All I want, you know, is to work in this country, you know, and make a living for my mom, because my mom is very sick. And he said, I let you go, he said, but if you pay me what I pay for you.
When she was 19, Marisol finally got out. Years later, she returned to Tijuana, only to find that her family wanted nothing to do with her. It was because of her scars and tattoos, put there by her captor to mark her as his property. Her family thought she was in a gang.
And how, I mean, here, people, they see you as a prostitute, drug addict. They don't see what happened to you, or they don't want to hear what happened to you.
Today, Marisol is visiting La Casa del Jardín, or the Garden House. It's a safe house for young women who have been coerced or sold into prostitution. The girls get language and math classes, along with music, art, and therapy. Alma Tucker opened the house last June.
If those girls are not treated right or adults, sometimes they can turn to be victimizers. Then it's one circle. Then we as a community, as authorities, we need to stop that circle. We need to give them the opportunity to heal.
Tucker saw that firsthand when she worked for the Mexican consulate in San Diego. Once, she visited a Mexican girl in the hospital who'd been raped by a smuggler when she was crossing the border.
The girl was 14 years old, and while I arrived, she was crying so strong, crying for mom, mom.
The memory of that girl stayed with her and led her to open a safe house years later. Now, Tucker goes back and forth across the border daily to meet with the girls and her hand-picked staff. The girls are sent to La Casa del Jardín after they're rescued by authorities in the United States and Mexico.
Hello, soy la señora Brenda Ruacho de Vega, presidenta del patronato DIF de Baja California.
Brenda Ruacho de Vega is the wife of the governor of Baja California and president of the state social services agency. As she tours the safe house, she gives out hugs and kisses and talks with the girls about their lives. Ruacho says by national efforts, like this one, are what's needed to end trafficking, because no one country can deal with it alone. It has to be a joint effort that harnesses the conscience of the community, she says.
Es un conjunto que una sola asociación no puede, un solo gobierno no puede, un solo país no puede. Esto es un trabajo de conjunto.
And there's an effort on the U.S. side, too. Rudy Ramirez is a city council member in Chula Vista, a few miles north of the border.
It's not the sort of thing that you expect happens anymore, right?
He's championing Tucker's cause, holding fundraisers for La Casa del Jardín.
You think this happens somewhere else, some other continent somewhere. And so it is surprising to hear that it happens here.
Back at the safe house, some of the girls are getting self-defense training. They also run and do yoga, which helps their self-image. Alma Tucker says it's crucial to give them the tools they need to reintegrate into society.
For those girls, they don't choose what they go through. And all those girls, they're not already victimized. They deserve better life.
Upstairs, Marisol Garcia says she wants people to know what happened to her so they can understand the toll that trafficking takes.
This is a wound that is going to stay forever with you. But of course, we have to live with it and we have to continue living. You know, and there's no choice, you know, we have to live life.
She offers testimonials to the girls at La Casa del Jardín and acts as an unofficial spokesperson. In many ways, her life until now has been stolen from her. But, she says, perhaps she can turn what happened to her into something that can help others. For Latino USA, I'm Brooke Binkowski in Tijuana, Mexico.
Globally, over 1 million children are trafficked for sex or forced labor. Though we just heard a story about sex trafficked women in Mexico, sex trafficking on both sides of the border is a product of American demand. Reporter Brooke Binkowski joins us now to talk more about sex trafficking on both sides of the border. Welcome to Latino USA, Brooke.
Thank you so much, Maria.
So let's talk about this American demand issue. We've heard it a lot in terms of drugs. We're hearing it now in terms of sex. But who, by and large, are the men who are having sex, the American men who are having sex with women who have been kidnapped and rented out for sex?
Well, a lot of these men, you see them a lot in San Diego, and they'll talk about it. They just say, oh, I'm going to go to, you know, find a whorehouse in Tijuana, they'll say. Or there's websites dedicated to finding the best prostitutes in all cities of the world. Tijuana is absolutely no exception. It's got this old, I suppose, warranted reputation for being this sort of playground for people, for foreigners, especially American men. I grew up in San Diego, so I remember a lot of people. First, they made jokes about it, saying, oh, I'm going to go find a prostitute in Tijuana. And then they stopped making jokes about it because they were actually doing it.
Now, what about the traffickers themselves? Recently, there was a big bust in San Diego involving gang members. What went on?
So these women weren't being trafficked across the border. They were being trafficked within the United States. Some of them continued to live at home. They weren't abducted or trafficked. They just kind of went out and did their 3 hours on the streets and came home with a lot of money.
How is the social media being used in the San Diego, Tijuana area to further the trafficking?
Basically, a lot of these traffickers are friends of the family or they're part of the family. They're known to the victim and they'll strike up a friendship and start grooming them, essentially doing the same thing that child molesters and traffickers do. And they'll say, hey, you know, I'm your friend. You can talk to me.
So there is a new initiative to combat sex trafficking within San Diego. What can you tell us about what the initiative is and the district attorney that's behind it?
Well, Bonnie Dumanis is our district attorney, and she has a sort of a mixed reputation, as far as I can tell. She's very tough on sexual abusers. She is doing this initiative with the help of other local lawmakers. What they're doing is they're putting posters up in at-risk businesses, massage parlors, bars, food places where you work for tips only or under the table. And they're putting these posters up saying, these are the signs of being trafficked. Call this number. We're here to help you. You know, and they're putting them up in several different languages, hoping that people will take advantage of this and call.
The trafficking of girls and women between San Diego and Tijuana has always been a problem. It's clearly getting worse. Are you thinking that there's going to be a downturn or it's going to probably get worse before it gets better?
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And unfortunately, although I think that posters are going to do some good, I don't think that they're going to help because the underlying issues are what need to be addressed. There's a demand. What I'm hearing is that there's been a big uptick in trafficking across the border because strangely enough, of higher border security.
And why did that would seem contradictory? Why
it
is
does,
that?
It does, doesn't it? But what happens is, you know, it used to be you could go find a pollero or a coyote and say, hey, you know, I want to get across the border into the United States. And the pollero would say, okay, and take the money. Now it's way more lucrative if something goes wrong to just find the younger people and say, well, we're just going to go ahead and sell you. And they'll either sell them to people in the United States or to pimps in Tijuana, or they'll just kill them and ask for ransom from the families.
Sounds distressing. Brooke, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Brooke Binkowski joined us from San Diego. Thanks again. Hey, Pueblo, it's Valentine's Day weekend, so we wanted to bring you a few little love stories throughout our hour together. Here are Yvette and Crystal Gonzalez Ale.
So when I was back in Oakland, I made a friend called Dejanira. And Dejanira ended up inviting Yvette.
Invited me to a radical queer dinner party. I went with her and I walked through the door and then
Dejanira and Yvette come in.
There was Crystal.
And so she was dressed to the nines. She was in a white flowy dress.
She was wearing a red t-shirt.
Gold necklace with a snake on it.
Black cardigan.
And everyone else was just like, you know, just hanging out. Jeans, t-shirt, and she comes in all done.
Yeah.
We had a lot in common.
She was really great. She was really cool.
We were both Cuban. She had just been to Cuba, so we spent a lot of time talking about that.
Also queer and also Cuban.
Also studied economics. In undergrad, she was about to go get her PhD in economics, and so we were basically just talking the whole night. We met on a Wednesday.
That friend that introduced us was leaving to Egypt, and she was having a going away party.
And she was having it at a
gay,
I don't know if it's normally gay, I think it's normally gay.
Paisa banda night.
And it's like legit folks just came across the border.
Gay Mexican cowboys that would go in matching outfits,
bedazzled,
like with bedazzled
boots and like the whole thing
is spectacular.
I don't know why it took me so long to actually kiss her, but she told me she was gonna give me a ride home. And I get in the front seat and you ask me, where are we going next?
Mm-hmm.
And I go, your place.
It was like 5 in the morning, we were still up.
And Yvette had her iPod or her computer on shuffle.
And like the sun was rising.
And we were laying in bed.
And the song from Cursive came on. I don't know if you know the band Cursive.
They're like an obscure band, and this song comes on called Gentleman Caller.
And I started singing along, and she started singing along to it.
But there's a part that goes, this morning we love like weaklings.
And we're like both laying in bed, like kind of like turning around, looking at each other, like how is it that you know all the words to this Cursive song? Like nobody knows this band.
It's such an obscure band that to find, you know, some random person that is not only is aware of Cursive, but can sing along to this particular song was pretty.
And I think it was at that moment that I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with her.
It was kind of magical.
Yeah, and I mean, we've been together ever since.
Yeah, I mean, we've been together for 4 years and married for 2 of them.
He's absolutely my best friend.
Coming up on Latino USA, sex workers.
Having a relationship with someone who was an adult was a way that I could get the things that I needed.
Working in and talking about the risks of the sex industry. Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For many people, sex and love are one and the same. For others, sex and sexuality can simply be a way to earn a living. They are prostitutes, exotic dancers, porn stars, or escorts. We just heard about the horror and sadness of those trafficked into sex work in La Frontera. But what about those who work in the sex industry by choice, or because it's just what they see as the best job and economic opportunity available to them? We talked to several people about these issues. First, we checked in with Kate D'Adamo, the community organizer for SWAP, the Sex Workers Outreach Project. Welcome to Latino USA, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just from a workers and kind of, what we understand labor and rights in this country, what do sex workers face?
You know, sex workers face a lot of the same challenges that you see in other forms of informal labor, people that are marginalized from more formal spaces, who have different needs. When you're talking about people who engage in the sex trade, you know, you're talking about the same challenges. The thing about the sex industry is it's a great deal of people who are just trying to kind of make things work in a very difficult situation.
So that's important because you're basically saying it exists around you. You may have a notion of what a sex worker is or where they are, but in fact, it has permeated because of this question of economic need.
Yeah, I mean, sex work is a form of economic justice.
Why do you say that?
You know, economic justice is about access to resources, and it's about doing it in a way that works for your life. A great deal of informal labor is really about just structuring your life in a way to get access to those kind of economic resources.
So how does race and ethnicity play into sex work in terms of policing and profiling? Is it a big issue?
It's absolutely an issue. And when you look at the statistics of who is being arrested either for prostitution, for solicitation of prostitution, when you look at things like the no condoms as evidence.
No condoms as evidence?
So no condoms as evidence is about the use of condoms as evidence of prostitution. And so sometimes if you're policing a community and, you know, race, class, the way that someone looks are all things that factor into the way policing occurs.
Kate D'Adamo, thank you so much for the work that you do and for coming for our studios here in Harlem.
Thank you for wanting to speak to this story. I think it's incredibly important.
So sex workers have been asked to justify the condoms in their purse or pocket. But what about love? We spoke to a young man about why he became a sex worker and how he sees the relationship between sex and love. Andy is a sex worker and an activist. And that is a pseudonym that we're using because of the nature of his work. He joins us here in the studios in Harlem. Welcome to Latino USA, Andy.
Hi.
So can you tell me how you got involved in the sex work and how it became something that was for you not a question of shame and victimization, but rather a question of choice?
I wouldn't characterize my entrance into the sex trades as a choice. So when I was younger, I was in what I characterize as survival sex relationships.
What does that mean, survival sex relationships?
I had very limited options and very limited resources at 15, and I needed to get out of certain situations. And through having a relationship with someone who was an adult was a way that I could get the things that I needed. And that evolved into a lot of different experiences or ways of trading, to street-based work, to working online, to the club, to other relationships. So, yeah, I think there's definitely been points at my life where I've definitely felt it was a choice and definitely felt empowered by the work that I do. But I also want to acknowledge and hold that that wasn't always the experiences, but those are the options available to me as someone younger, as someone who didn't want to be in foster care or be sent home.
What made you decide to become an activist?
When I was 19 years old, I had a friend that went missing, and it was in a work situation. She actually ended up being okay, but I was under the idea that she might have been killed or that something bad had happened to her while working. And something clicked in making these connections about why is this so risky? And like, how can this just happen? How can someone just disappear? And that's when I originally got involved with SWAP. And since then, I've been involved in a lot of various other movements or organizing spaces.
So for you, is sex tied to love?
I mean, sex is a lot of different things for a lot of people. I think if we're looking at the way sex has been constructed throughout the last hundreds of years, we see sex attached with all kinds of different meanings throughout. I mean, what did sex look like before women had rights and were able to organize or talk about their lives or demand things from larger structures? Or what does sex mean in patriarchy for women? I mean, I feel like sex is at questions for a lot of people in a lot of different circumstances. So I think for some people, yeah, that's definitely a place that sex means or is connected to like these larger ideas about love. But I was thinking there's just different types of sex.
There's like a judgment, though. The judgment is placed that if you have sex for work, then there's something wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're even moving to a place where promiscuity isn't, at least in a lot of mainstream things, looked down upon. But selling sex is still. And there's so many reasons as to why there's stigma.
Do you, in the work that you do as an activist and just in general, do you always see these kinds of contradictions of American society?
I don't see them as contradictions. I think they actually have a really specific history and legacy. And I connect it to colonialism. And I connect it to the beginning of settler colonialism in the U.S. and the ways in which brown and black bodies have always been policed. And our sexualities and our gender identities have always been policed. As a queer person and as a queer person of color, as a queer Latino, and coming from a community of queer people of color and young queer people of color who are doing the things that they needed to do to survive, and the types of policing we encountered isn't being encountered by other folks or white folks. There's a really big connection to these other ways that we've been policed and monitored by the state and racial profiling and discriminatory and like all of these things. So I find it, I actually don't find it random or odd. I think there's a very specific purpose, and that purpose is to police folks of color and to monitor.
But paint that picture, because it seems like you're saying there are sex workers who work on the street who are not of color and they don't get harassed.
No, that's not particularly what I'm saying. I'm saying people of color are overrepresented in the sex trades. And that's connected to a lot of other economic issues in this country. This is, for a lot of folks, a viable way to supplement your income, a viable way to make income, especially for younger folks and younger LGBTQ folks who may be leaving home or trying to stay out of foster care, or like, this becomes an option to evade being put into abusive situations. What I'm saying is that we make up, people of color, blacks and Latinos in this country, make up a really large number of folks who are involved in the sex trades. And there's reasons for that. And those reasons don't look like what we're predominantly thought of when we think of like sex trafficking. They're actually tied to economic issues. But sex trafficking often provides this mask, so we don't have to actually look at these other things that are happening.
So that if you only talk about sex trafficking, then you only see the people involved in sex work as victims, and therefore people who, as you say, make a choice to do sex work don't have a voice.
What I'm saying is that the emphasis on the trafficker creates an impulse to find that trafficker and stop them. And if we only are focusing on that, we're not addressing other things like livable wages, access to employment, job trainings, affordable housing. We don't have to deal with those things or ask those questions. All we have to do is find this person and stomp them. And what that actually looks like is a bunch of new laws that criminalize tons of more people and make everyone become involved in riskier behaviors, especially for undocumented Latinos. And they really put people even further at risk and further away from the surface, to say, and create these situations where we're even less safe in this attempt to find the trafficker. But really, it's about not dealing with these other issues.
So do you feel like you are part of a movement to really change the narrative?
Yeah, I definitely feel a part of this larger movement. And I also feel a part of a movement to fold this into other issues. There's this idea that we're regulated to some space over here, that we're not being racially profiled, that we're not facing discrimination on the basis of other identities that we hold, that we're transgender, that we're queer, that we're young, that we're disabled. You know, so I think I'm very much interested in fighting and being a part of this movement over here. And I'm also really want to pull in that, like, we are your mothers and your sons and your brothers and your next door neighbors. And we have all of these other identities and complexities, and that we need to come to our organizing work as a full person.
Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. After speaking with Andy, we wanted to know more about the link between sex work, race, and policing. So we called up Carolina Martin Ramos, the owner and managing attorney of the law firm Justicia Digna, and an advocate for sex workers' rights. She joins us from the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome to Latino USA, Carolina.
Thank you. Buenos dias, Maria.
So how is sex work racialized, and how does this affect women of color?
So sex work is racialized in that it's a stratified type of workforce. Sex workers report that white women may be able to have access to, you know, a fancy hotel without being harassed, whereas women of color trying to enter that same space will be harassed and policed differently. And even outside of those private spaces, out on the street, the police will police women's bodies differently, where they will let white women engage in sex work in perhaps safer neighborhoods and areas, and women of color will be sort of subjugated to more dangerous areas where they're at more risk, where they're also pushed to engage in riskier behavior, and they're paid less.
So it's kind of like a complaint that they have on the job that's very real about their working conditions.
Right. And because of the way that sex workers are stigmatized and marginalized, and particularly when they're engaged in conduct that's considered criminal or illegal, they don't have anywhere to go complain. There's nowhere for them to assert their civil rights or their workers' rights. And so those systems continue to operate that way.
So you as a lawyer, you're against anti-trafficking legislation? Why?
I'm not completely against anti-trafficking legislation. So basically, the trafficking legislation that we have right now in the United States was developed in this weird relationship between the Christian right and what we call abolitionist feminists, who are against pornography and completely against prostitution and don't see any type of sex work as something that someone can have agency in. And some of the folks who have created the anti-trafficking legislation we have are very anti-prostitution, and they insist that they will not fund folks who don't make pledges against prostitution. They cannot receive funding to help their clients or for HIV programs.
This was something that your mom actually, she did engage at some point in her life in sex work.
In my mom's experience, she used these opportunities to get out of bad situations, to be able to put a roof over her head, to be able to feed other people, and ultimately to be able to cross the border. And I've heard other stories very much like my mother's story. But I think because sex work is so stigmatized, so many of us are taught to hide those stories and to treat them as shameful, when in fact they're actually beautiful stories of courage and honor.
Carolina Martin Ramos, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Muchas gracias, María.
Thanks again to Crystal Du Bois, Katie Adamo, Andy, and Carolina Martin Ramos.
Ando buscando un pajarito del amor que solía volar a mi alrededor, que me daba besos al volar y me quería tanto.
Getting married is a big decision. But if you're undocumented, there are a whole lot more questions than just, will you marry me? For Jimmy Barraza and Lily Zavala, a couple from New Orleans, these became more than just hypothetical questions.
Mi nombre es Lilian Zavala.
Soy originario de Honduras.
Lily and Jimmy, both originally from Honduras, met in New Orleans. He was a laborer working on post-Katrina construction sites. She was supporting herself by cooking meals for the workers. On the weekend, she would come to the park and watch him play soccer. He scored lots of goals, Lily says. They fell in love, moved in together, and had two kids. But they never got married. They talked about it now and then, but Jimmy never felt ready. Everything in their lives was going well, until it wasn't.
One day, like any other day in their family life, they had gone to the supermarket.
This is Jacinta Gonzalez, a labor organizer who knows the couple well.
And Jimmy was unloading groceries from his car into his house.
Yo venía llegando y se bajaron con las pistolas.
When all of a sudden, ICE agents pulled up and surrounded them with their guns pointed at him.
The agents fingerprinted Jimmy and took him away to a detention center. Jimmy's arrest was part of a broader wave of immigrant detentions happening in New Orleans in 2013 as part of a pilot program called CARI, the Criminal Alien Removal Initiative. Jimmy was no criminal, but he is undocumented and had skipped a court date many years ago. An ICE spokesperson told us, ICE does not conduct sweeps or raids to target undocumented immigrants indiscriminately. But Jacinta says that's exactly what the local field office in Louisiana was doing.
Ay, no sé, como algo tremendo que nunca esperé en mi vida.
Lily remembers the tears pouring from her eyes when they took Jimmy away. Soon after, she found the Congress of Day Laborers, the group Jacinta works for, and began working with them to petition ICE for Jimmy's release.
Dice, no se preocupe, vamos a luchar.
After 28 days, Jimmy was set free. But while he was in detention, he made a decision.
Después de esto que pasó, verdaderamente yo sentí en mí que este era el momento.
Jimmy came up with an elaborate plan for a surprise proposal in front of the Congress of Day Laborers that helped get him out.
Yo veo que todas las personas están como agarradas de la mano, como si fuese un...
Lily thought she was going to a normal meeting, but when she arrived, the crowd of 200 people were all holding hands.
She thought that she was playing a game with the kids, and so she started to run through, and the hands were opening up, until at the end, Jimmy was there with roses for her. And they started playing her favorite song. And then he proposed. But the way that he proposed is everyone in the crowd had big signs that letter by letter spelled out, "Will you marry me?" In Spanish.
Yo sentí que mi corazón como que se me iba a parar.
And, you know, Lily was really overwhelmed. But what was funny is one of the things that the sayings that has come up from the national movement to get people to feel empowered is sin papeles, sin miedo. No papers, no fear. And so as Jimmy is on one knee asking her if she will marry him, the first thing that comes out of her mouth is sin papeles.
Sin papeles.
And the entire crowd goes crazy saying sin miedo. And then she says yes.
Beso, beso, beso.
Everyone agreed. It was a beautiful moment. But?
But, you know, Jimmy continues to be in deportation proceedings.
For now, he's able to continue building his life with Lily and their kids.
But he has no idea how long he's going to be able to continue to be in his children's lives. He doesn't know if he's going to be asked to leave in 3 months, in 3 years.
Como estar de las manos con él, pero agarrado de un dedo nada más, que en cualquier momento.
For Lily, it's hard. She says it's like being in his arms, but holding on by just a finger. But she's trying to stay optimistic.
Y sobre todo, yo creo que con amor vamos a llegar muy lejos.
Above all else, says Lily, I think that with love, we're going to go far. Love is the most important thing.
El amor es todo y es lo más importante.
Por eso elevo mi voz, bendiciendo tu nombre y pidiéndote
Coming up on Latino USA.
In the last 8 years, I have seen multicultural weddings skyrocket.
The Texas wedding planner whose specialty is intercultural love. Amor sin fronteras, people. Stay with us. No se vayan.
I love you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. If you think drag is just men dressing up like women, then you don't know about the love drag performers have for their art. As the new season of the hit reality competition RuPaul's Drag Race gets set to air, we wanted to look at one group whose passion pops through the screen. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario introduces us to some of the fiercest queens.
You better work.
When you think of drag queens, it's possible that the only name that comes to mind is RuPaul. That's fair. RuPaul has had arguably the most successful career in drag ever. A few years ago, he launched a reality show on Logo called RuPaul's Drag Race. It quickly became my favorite show. And it stayed my favorite show. In part because it featured a series of ferocious Puerto Rican queens. In fact, in its 5 seasons, every single one has had at least one, if not more. Which, numbers-wise, seems crazy. It's such a small island. And yet there were so many standout queens. I mean, it wasn't until the show's 5th season that it had a queen from San Francisco. And that city's a gay mecca. I wanted to figure out, what is it about Puerto Rican drag queens?
My name is Michelle Visage, and I am the biggest, baddest judge on RuPaul's Drag Race, after RuPaul, of course.
Visage joined the show in the 3rd season, but has worked with RuPaul for years.
Well, you can't have a drag queen show without Puerto Rican.
She would know. Before becoming a radio and TV personality, Visage began her career as a singer in the group Seduction. They were formed by the same guys behind CNC Music Factory. She spent some time in clubs.
When I first moved to New York City from New Jersey, I was 17. I moved there to go to college. And when I got involved in the gay scene and I started going to balls and walking ballrooms and stuff, it was all with Puerto Ricans. The queens that I grew up with in New York City, like in houses and stuff, were all Black, Puerto Rican, and Dominican.
For her, it's not the Latinos that are new to drag.
The white queens, to me, came later on. I don't see drag without Latinos at all. The originals. I mean, hello, look at Edie Chacon, look at Celia Cruz.
She's got a point. Both Chacon and Cruz were mega divas, which is exactly what the queens of RuPaul's Drag Race are going for. The show itself is sort of a hybrid between Project Runway and America's Next Top Model. And RuPaul plays both the mentor in the style of Tim Gunn and the mother judge like Tyra.
This is your last chance to impress me.
At the end of every episode, the two queens with the lowest score face off to see who stays.
Time has come. Get your lip sync for your life.
That's right. They lip sync. Because that's what drag queens do. It's campy, it's silly, and yet it requires the contestants to have real skill. Visage knows what she's looking for when judging.
So I really like confidence first and foremost. I also think a look needs to tell a story.
For the queens themselves, it's something else.
What I love about me doing drag is that I get to be somebody else for whatever time I'm in it. It gives me an escape of reality.
That's Alexis Mateo, a fan favorite from season 3. She was one of 2 Puerto Ricans on that season.
Yes, it was the Puerto Rican power season. I love it.
So what makes the Puerto Rican queens special?
I actually think we have the magic. I tell everybody always tell me, what is it about, especially Puerto Rican girls that come to the show and turn the party? And I'm like, I don't know. I think we have the magic.
She also says that going to school on the island prepares you for the fashion challenges on the show.
It's obligated for you to graduate from high school and attend at least one of the sewing classes.
And Mateo told me something that surprised me about many of the queens on the show. There are more incognito Latinos than you think.
Well, but people doesn't know that it's so many Latinas. We had Delta work in my season who was Mexican. It's, you know, like, it's a lot of us that have a lot of background, like Carmen Carrera and all of us that doesn't get featured as Hispanic characters, but we are. We all are.
When season 6 airs, we'll see if the trend continues. But we do know that, like every season so far, it definitely features a Puerto Rican queen. This season, that contestant is...
My name is April Carrion.
Carrion started performing drag 5 years ago. As an art student, she was immediately intrigued by the way that drag both questions and makes fun of gender. I asked why she thought such a small island turns out such big talent.
We are so tiny, but we are so multicultural, diverse. I mean, we have influences from Africa, from Spain, from all over the world, and we are in this huge melting pot.
Carrion is anticipating the life changes that come with appearing on a TV show. She doesn't know exactly what it will be like, but already has a few opportunities lined up.
Like right now, I'm booked for a bunch of shows in cities I've never been. Like, I'm so excited just to travel all over United States. Like, I've never been to San Francisco.
But the thing she's most excited for is
to freaking see snow. Like, that for me is gonna be life-changing.
Mateo says being on season 3 changed her life in many ways. One of the best ones has been the fans. Not just the Latino fans, but the families. Parents who share the show with their kids.
A little 6-year-old girl brought me a Barbie doll, and she told me that her mom and her did it for myself, and she made their clothes and the makeup and everything.
She took the doll backstage and showed it to the other performers.
And I realized that the Barbie doll was a Ken doll with a wig on, and it was hilarious. Everybody laughed backstage and everything, but I thought it was so special that somebody would have taken the time to explain to the little kids what was the transformation.
The Puerto Rican queens may have the magic, but for Mateo, the real magic is the way the fun of the show opens people up to difference and diversity.
In my personal opinion, I think it's the step close to change the world.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
So, who will you be rooting for this season on RuPaul's Drag Race? Give us a shout out on Twitter. We're at Latino USA. 15% of all marriages in the U.S. are interracial or interethnic. But, no surprise, Pew says, this number is growing pretty darn fast and has been rising steadily since the 1980s. It's even starting to have an economic effect. You might remember this Cheerios commercial from last year.
Mom.
Yes, honey?
Dad told me that Cheerios is good for your heart. Is that true?
Cheer!
But it's having an effect on a smaller scale, too. Audrey Hugh Gonzalez is a wedding planner in Houston, Texas, who specializes in throwing intercultural wedding ceremonies.
My name is Audrey Hugh Gonzalez, and I am a wedding planner in Houston, Texas. In the last 8 years, I have seen multicultural weddings skyrocket. Many young couples getting out of college, meeting in college, meeting at work, they're starting to fall in love, and they just seem to be more open to marrying outside of their race more lately now than ever. I basically do a lot of multicultural weddings, I think mainly because of the fact that I myself am a multicultural person. I am half Bolivian, half Chinese. When people find out that I'm half Chinese or half Spanish and I speak the language, especially Spanish, they feel very comfortable with me. The couple, she was from Mexico. They had a mariachi during the cocktail hour. They did Nigerian music throughout the evening. And they actually had a Nigerian DJ and a Nigerian MC to do the event throughout the night, but they did play a lot of salsa music. The great thing about this wedding is not only did they have Mexican and Nigerian food, but everybody, from Mexican to Nigerian to anybody, they were all dancing. They had Mexican food, they had fajitas, and they had pico de gallo, they have rice, they had tortillas, and then right next door they had a buffet of Nigerian food, which was beautiful because each culture got a taste of each food, and everybody loved it, and it was phenomenal. We incorporated each culture specifically, for example, you know how we do wedding introductions. With Nigerian family has a different way of doing introductions, you know, Mexican, Latin cultures have different ways. We also incorporated the dollar dance, which is very Latin. And we also did the money throwing, where in Nigerian culture what they do is they actually dance and people go around and throw money at them. And it's my job to sweep it up and put all the money in the bag. Hoy
In my business, doing multicultural weddings, I have seen awkward moments. I have seen where, for example, a couple, maybe the parents, aren't always accepting towards the wedding. Sometimes it's always best. I know that you would love to have your mother and father to come to the wedding, but if you're worried that they're going to cause issues, sometimes it's always for the best that they don't show up. That way, you can enjoy the wedding. You can enjoy the wedding and not be stressed and not be sad about other things. It has happened. Even I've had a sister of the bride who did not agree with the wedding and she didn't show up. So I think the best thing to do is, I always tell my brides, you know, I know you want your family members there, but if they're not accepting at the end, enjoy what is being married. Enjoy your husband or your wife and make sure that you love each other. It's not about them. It's about you as a couple. And I think that's really, really important.
Audrey Hugh Gonzalez is a wedding planner who spoke to us from KUHF in Houston, Texas. Sometimes, in spite of all you've gone through, you owe a friend a love letter just for being there. Our senior producer, AC Valdez, wrote this one.
First, there was Katie. At 15, she was my best friend, and I can prove it was love by way of simple cooperative stupidity. We'd tear around DC suburbs, drive by Ralphing. You know, while your friend dives down the street, you lean out the passenger side window and wave at the stop sign to the suburban walkers yelling, "Hey, Ralph!" 90% of people, most likely not named Ralph, will wave back at you. A while after we'd been hanging out, I asked her to go out with me, and true to how teenage romance goes, we dated for all of a week. Truth was, she was lesbian, and we both loved, in only the way teenagers can, this other girl, Mary. I couldn't be angry. But then along came Laura. Laura with the impossibly beautiful teeth, the perfectly round cheeks, the wrestling scholarship. And Laura was mine. Until she was Katie's one afternoon while we hung out on Laura's couch, the two of them making out and me storming out of the living room. We didn't talk for a month. And in that long period of silence, I waited it out. A cheater's a cheater, and I figured it would only be a matter of time before my best friend would be back. And eventually, Katie was back, after Laura reconnected with the boy she'd had on the side the whole time, even when she was with me. We drifted after a while, after Katie stopped showing up to school. She'd been robo-tripping, drinking Robitussin to get high, getting sent to hospitals, skipping out on school. She was one of the few people I knew with the courage to come out of the closet, even in spite of her parents. I confided in her about the only guy I've ever really had romantic feelings for. After meeting him, she seemed less than impressed. She opened my eyes to his casual racism, homophobia, things that came so easily as part of an upbringing where we lived. Soon enough, she moved in with a girl named Sam. They were nannies for a couple of kids out in the exurbs, living in a guest house and trying to protect the kids from their parents, who were hoarders, and ignored the fact that nearly everyone in the household had scabies. In the middle of the night, must have been 9 or 10 p.m., I helped them box their things. They were trying to leave without the parents of the kids catching on. They crashed at my place, and the next morning they flew out. Sam developed a nasty habit of sleeping around and taking ecstasy. And eventually Katie came back. At that point, I'd pretty much given up on her as my f*** up friend, that person who lives hard so you don't have to, although I always tried to be there when she needed it. I owe her the world, or I should say him. Katie's gone by Tom for a while now. Over the years, the push for GLBT rights has grown stronger, and I count myself lucky to have become an adult with someone who, for all their flaws, helped me understand why their rights and issues mattered in very personal ways. Over the course of years, Tom's turned his life around. He got to be a grown-up by a very different path than I did, managing a FedEx while going to community college. He lives with his partner and two beautiful kids, and as far as I can tell, life for him has never been so stable. I wish we all had a Tom. It's this friendship, this personal attachment, this love, that's changed the attitudes of so many people. So I guess this is a love letter. Tom, happy Valentine's Day.
And happy Valentine's Day to you, AC, and to your friend Tom. Sometimes I feel I've got to. They say love conquers all. But sometimes the practicalities of life get in the way of the fairy tale, and that's especially true for couples caught in the uncertainties of immigration. Our last Latino love story for the day is also this week's sabiduría, or words of wisdom. Edilia González married her husband Ramiro just weeks before leaving Colombia for New York on a student visa. The idea was that her husband would come and join her soon after. But that didn't happen. Ramiro's visa request was denied. Edilia tells us her story.
I came first hoping that he was going to come within a month or so, and that didn't happen. He stayed there for 6 long months. In the meantime, even though I was trying to get adjusted to this culture, I remember feeling extremely sad that the winter came and it was a totally new experience for me. I wrote to my father and I told him that I wanted to go back to Colombia, that Ramiro wasn't coming, that we didn't know when his papers were going to come through. And up to this day, I will never forget his words. He wrote to me and he told me that you have to face the battles, the difficulties, you face them and you solve them. Don't give up so quickly. And sure enough, with patience and determination and I will say luck, he came, and spring was around the corner back in New York City in Brooklyn. It was like the beginning of our real life as a couple. And you can just imagine the joy at the Kennedy Airport to see him coming. The expectations are sometimes different from the reality, but yet the love is still there and the love is what really sustains you.
Edilia and Ramiro González will celebrate their 41st wedding anniversary later this year. These days, they live in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And mis queridos, that's it for this week's Latino USA on love and how we justify it. And my Valentine's shout out goes to my best friend and unofficial hermano, Santiago, who was my official photographer and who we lost way too soon. Pilar, tu hijo fue un gran ejemplo de ser humano. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Jonathan Wolf, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Antonia Cerejido and Danielle Gunter. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, from our studios in Harlem. And join us again next week. In the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Can you say BAM for me?
BAM!
Thank you!
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. This is NPR.